Moncrief on News Talk.
Now, despite the fact that most movies aren't made there anymore, Hollywood is still the capital of the American film industry, and as such, it generates a huge celebrity tourism industry. Tours can show you where the celebrities hang out, where they live, or even where they're buried. Henry McKean went on a tour to see where the stars go for their eternal rest.
Hi, I'm Carrie Bible, the tour guide at Hollywood Forever Cemetery.
Carrie, we're here at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery. It's beautiful, it's peaceful, with very, very tall palm trees. Tell us about this lovely place.
Well, the cemetery was originally established in 1899, so it's been here quite a long time. And after a really sad period of neglect in the 70s and 80s, it was taken over by our current owner in the late 90s. And he's spent millions of dollars bringing this place back to its rightful place of glory. We have movie screenings here, concerts, yoga classes, tours, events, and it's a cemetery, of course, but it's also a cultural space in Los Angeles. And it's probably one of the most beautiful, unique cemeteries in the country.
For you, Hollywood, LA, Tinseltown, there is so much history. Mm-hmm. Just walking around, I feel like I'm in an old black and white movie or perhaps LA Confidential. There's that feeling, isn't there?
Oh,
and
yes.
And it's steeped in history.
I kind of live that feeling. I live in an old apartment. I collect vintage clothes. So I definitely live the old Hollywood style as much as that's possible to do.
Are people still buried here?
Yes, people are still buried here all the time. On the tour, we have a variety of stars from the past and the present, including we have Anne Heche, who was recently interred here. We have Chris Cornell of the band Soundgarden. But we also have a ton of silent film stars, classic Hollywood film stars. So it really runs the gamut from the earliest days of cinema all the way up to right now.
So, Carrie, we started the tour. What have we come across?
Well, we already saw the Hollywood sign, which turned 100 last year. And now we're at the cages for our peacocks. Our peacocks are sort of famous here as well. And nothing is arbitrary in a cemetery. If something's here, it's usually got a reason. And the peacocks are said to be a symbol of eternal life in the Buddhist religion, and also a symbol of good luck. Well, you're going to notice we have a lot of Russian and Armenian graves throughout the cemetery. Years ago, I asked an Armenian lady, I said, you know, out of all the cemeteries in Southern California, what's the draw to being here? And she explained to me that a lot of cemeteries out there, they usually make people have flat rectangular markers on the ground, kind of like over there. Here, we give people a lot of creative freedom. They like having a garden oftentimes in the middle of the grave. It gives the families a place to grieve, to spend time with their loved one. It's not unusual, especially maybe Sunday afternoons, to see families burning incense, maybe playing chess, picnicking. I saw some Armenian guys line vodka shots up and down a grave one day. So whatever form it takes, it gives the families a place to spend time with their loved one. Now, I used to assume that these faces that are etched on these black stones were done by laser, right? Well, a few years ago, I was giving a tour and I kept hearing this really high-pitched noise. I am not going to recreate it for you, but trust me when I say it was very loud, ear-splitting, and deeply annoying. Mm. And I kept thinking, what is that sound? I followed the sound. I came upon one of these graves. There was a little old man. He had a photograph on an easel. He had a hammer and a chisel, and he was doing that with hammer and chisel. My jaw nearly hit the floor. I had absolutely no idea this was even possible. I later found out the man is a fourth generation stone cutter who works for the cemetery. In 2024, I didn't know we had fourth generation trade or craftspeople. I didn't think that was a thing. It just, my mind was just blown that this was even happening. We're going to see a couch covered in dogs as a grave. Mike Szymanski, by the way, Mike is still alive and well. I know him, he's lovely. He's a journalist, and we all needed hobbies during lockdown, and that is true. Mike decided to have his own grave built and designed. And each one of these dogs here is modeled after a different dachshund that Mike has owned in his lifetime, including one up there with the missing ear. And this one is in tribute to all the dachshunds he owns right now and all of the dachshunds he intends to own in his future. And sometimes I get Mike to take the tour and pop up from behind his own grave and talk about it, which is a lovely way to freak people out. But he's very busy. I can't ask that on a weekly basis. That's like a special occasion thing. But in any case, he's got a pin after his birth date instead of a dash, because technically he's still writing his own future.
Do you find that refreshing?
I do, actually. I picked out my own grave here during lockdown as well, because I started thinking about it. Okay, there's this new deadly virus. We don't know much about it. I'm alone. My whole family is 3,000 miles east. And I thought, you know, it would not be a bad idea to get those plans rolling, because I've known a lot of people over the years that have died in Los Angeles. They didn't make plans. They didn't have a will. They didn't have family or whatever. Stuff goes in the trash, drama happens, chaos happens. And I think that when people make those plans, it's a real gift to those who survive them. Long before Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, there was Vampyra. She was the first to wear the long, slinky gown, the fingernails, and the campy sense of humor. She had her own show briefly in Los Angeles in the mid-1950s, and she also co-starred in Ed Wood's opus, Plan 9 from Outer Space. And she continues to be a very popular and beloved goth icon. There are books about her, documentaries, and even products as well. Darren McGavin was a character actor. He was most famous for his role as Ralphie's father in the holiday classic A Christmas Story. Remember the leg lamp? He also played Mickey Spillane's Mike Hammer and Kolchak's The Night Stalker. And our triple flush marches on with the grave of Mr. Blackwell. Mr. Blackwell was a famous fashion designer for actresses like Jane Mansfield and Yvonne DiCarlo, but found his greatest fame as a fashion critic, where he issued scathing poems and statements about the way famous ladies dressed. Cher was a particularly favorite target, Mr. Blackwell's brand of ire. He also had a fashion design empire with his partner of 59 years, Robert L. Spencer. And he wrote a very salacious book about his life called From Rags to Bitches. And long before Joan Rivers, Mr. Blackwell gets the credit as the world's first acid-tongued red carpet critic. Walter Huston won Best Supporting Actor for Treasures of the Sierra Madre in the late 1940s. John won Oscars as well for that film. And then in 1985, John's daughter, Angelica, won Best Supporting Actress for the film Pritzi's Honor, which he directed. So this made them Hollywood's first family with three generations in a row of Oscar winners. The only other family to achieve that is the Coppola family. And John Huston was also an actor in his own right, appearing as the evil Noah Cross in the classic Chinatown, and also the cult shocker Myra Breckinridge. And John Huston had a tremendous love for the country of Ireland, and this is Connemara marble with a Celtic band in the center on his headstone. Sorry, it's so loud with the
helicopters. They're probably going over to the Hollywood sign. That's probably
this
Brad Pitt.
This happens all the time.
And John Huston's gravestone is underneath this beautiful bush that his family probably planted.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to see it, but the bush is quite overgrown. But yes, you can see John Huston. He's also buried with his mother, and then his grandmother is right there.
So this is real Hollywood A-list stuff.
Yes, it certainly is. A-list Oscar winners. And several years ago, I was doing my tour, and I'm standing here doing my spiel with the binder. I turn around, Angelica was standing right there. And I normally pride myself in being very articulate, and I was like, I can't suddenly form words in the presence of this woman. But she was very nice, though.
Do you come across Hollywood ghosts here in the graveyard?
You know, I don't. And I've been here 22 years. I've been here for shoots I've done at 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning, midnight. I've never had any kind of ghostly encounter. I know people find that hard to believe, but it's true. Here's my theory on this, though. I think if they exist, I don't think they're going to come when you are expecting them. Like, I've had some of the guys who do the ghost shows on reality stuff take the tour, and they have their radars and all their equipment, and I'm thinking they're not going to come running when you call them. They're not like a dog. I think they're going to come when you absolutely least expect expect it. Like 3 a.m. when you have to go to the bathroom, that's when they are coming for you. And I also think too, they would go to a place that maybe had to do with their life, had to do with where something major happened in their life, a childhood home where they went to school. I don't think they're gonna come to the cemetery, oddly enough. So I do a night tour occasionally as well. And I've never had any sort of paranormal encounters here, which again, I know people find that hard to believe, but I haven't. And someone also asked, is there still room here? Our cemetery was founded in 1899, and as of 2024, we have 50 years of ground space. But when that 50 years is up, that 50 years is up. And in a lot of major cities like Los Angeles, you kind of have to start building up and not out and under. So at the very end of the tour, we'll see it. We are building a gigantic new mausoleum on our property. It is the tallest mausoleum in the United States, and it will hold 30,000 crypts, and it will have a viewing platform with sweeping views of the city on top of the building.
What do you think of this cemetery tour?
I think it's really cool. It's really informative. I like all the historical facts to it. It's not just, oh, this person was buried here. Did you know that? It's like all the history behind them.
What do you think?
Living here my whole life, I never even knew this cemetery existed until a few months ago when my mom came and she was like, you should totally come and visit here. And to see what a beautiful place to be buried here really makes me thankful to see that people still care about people after they passed.
I am from Colorado, so I'm like totally infatuated with like all this film and all this history stuff, you know, moving to LA. And I think it's really like, it's such a great opportunity to come out here and see like all this beauty and like remember lives that still impact us to this day. And yeah, I find it very informative and it's very nice.
So, I really enjoy this so much. So, my family's from Armenia, and a lot of Armenian people live here in West Hollywood. It was very delightful to see that, like, some facts are being, like, said about, like, you know, our traditions, our practices, and it just warmed my heart to know that you knew them, and it's just so insightful and so good to hear, like, a part of your history that not everyone would know, so.
There's lots of Irish connections here, isn't
yes,
there, in
yes,
this beautiful Hollywood Forever graveyard.
Yes, we have director William Desmond Taylor here. He was originally born in Carlow, Ireland, and he was born William C. Dean Tanner, and he came to America. He became an actor and then a filmmaker here in Hollywood. And sadly, if people know him today, they know the fact that he was murdered. He was found dead on his floor of his bungalow on Alvarado in downtown Los Angeles, February 1st, 1922. And his murder is unsolved to this day. It's one of Hollywood's great unsolved mysteries. But when it was the 100th anniversary of his murder 2 years ago in 2022, I called the cemetery and said, is there any sort of memorial or service? They said, no. I said, can I do one? And they said, go right ahead. So I called two gentlemen friends of mine who live in Los Angeles who are Irishmen. One of them is from Dublin and the other is from Carlow. And so we threw together a last minute Irish wake and we played 1920s Irish music. We gave speeches, we had flowers. I felt that nobody wants how you are remembered to be your name, comma, murder victim. Like nobody wants that. So I felt that on the 100 year anniversary of his murder, we ought to celebrate his life, his career, his legacy, and that's what we did. I always try to honor a behind the scenes person because I think a lot of people see movies and they think about the stars, maybe the director, but there is an army of creative talent who seldom get the credit they deserve. And Harold Rawson was one of them. He was a cinematographer, which meant he did the lighting and camera work on film. He started working in silent film and shot several films for Gloria Swanson. And then he was hired by MGM in 1930. He shot several films for Jean Harlow, cinema's first platinum blonde bombshell, including Red Dust, Red-Headed Woman, and Bombshell. He became Harlow's third husband, but that would last only a few months. He went on to get a special Academy Award for his work on The Garden of Allah with Marlene Dietrich. He also shot The Wizard of Oz, Singing in the Rain, The Asphalt Jungle, and earned a career total of 4 Oscar nominations. This is a photo of him announcing his elopement with Jean Harlow at a press conference. And below, he's checking out Marilyn Monroe while she chats with John Huston on the set of The Asphalt Jungle. And I love how interconnected the cemetery is, because so many of these artists here either were friends or spouses or lovers or worked together or something. So Harold Rawson shot two movies for John Huston, who we just saw over there, and then he shot two movies for our next grave, which is Cecil B. DeMille. He started working in silent film in 1913, and he would go on to direct the silent version of The Ten Commandments in the 1920s, and then the talking and Technicolor version in the 1950s with Charlton Heston. He co-founded Paramount Pictures, and he was a true titan of industry and directed numerous classic films throughout his storied career. And many film fans know him for his appearance in Sunset Boulevard, where Gloria Swanson has that famous line, "I'm ready for my close-up, Mr. DeMille." There's a lot of art imitating life in that film. In real life, DeMille had been Gloria's director in the teens and 20s when she was a huge star. He was a friend, a father figure, and a mentor to Gloria. So that relationship is very similar to what you see in Sunset Boulevard. And some other DeMille family members I would like to point out. Oh, by the way, DeMille did win an Oscar as well. He won the Best Picture Academy Award for the film The Greatest Show on Earth. And if you saw that movie The Fabelmans about Steven Spielberg's life, that was the movie he saw in the theater with his parents as a little boy that inspired him to become a filmmaker.
People still come to Hollywood to try and make it. Some of them end up becoming homeless. Mrs. DeMille changed that. She tried to help.
I wouldn't say she permanently changed it, but she certainly did what she could to help a lot of these people, especially young women. So she was instrumental in the founding of the Hollywood Studio Club. It was a house in Hollywood where young women could go. They paid a monthly fee. They got three meals a day. They got a room. They had people from the industry come and talk to them about working in Hollywood. And the point of this house was to give young women a safe and nurturing environment to begin their careers. And thanks in part to Mrs. DeMille, this home opened in 1916, and it lasted until 1975.
Carrie, we have Janet Gaynor's grave here. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about this movie star.
Janet Gaynor was the first Best Actress Academy Award winner. She basically won for three films, which is only time this has ever happened in Academy history. It was the early days, so they didn't have all the rules and regulations that we have now. So basically she won for the film Seventh Heaven, Street Angel, and F.W. Murnau's classic Sunrise. She was notified of her win several months in advance, so there was no suspense on the big night. And when asked what it felt like to take home the Oscar statue, she said, quote, "Well, I was just real excited to meet Mr. Fairbanks." So things have certainly changed a lot since then. Janet got another nomination in the late 30s for the first official version of A Star is Born. Of course, it has been continually remade in the 1950s with Judy Garland, the 1970s with Barbara Streisand, and 2018 with Lady Gaga. Jane Mansfield's earthly remains are in Pennsylvania, where she has a large upright heart-shaped monument. But several of her fans felt she deserved a local marker here in Hollywood, and I have to agree with them. Jane Mansfield was a voluptuous platinum blonde sex bomb in the 1950s and 60s. She starred in some appropriately titled films like The Girl Can't Help It and Too Hot to Handle. She was married to bodybuilder Mickey Hargitay, and they had a pink mansion with a heart-shaped pool. Unfortunately, they got a divorce, and Jane went on the road doing nightclub acts, television, whatever work she could find, when she was killed in a very grisly and horrible car accident. Contrary to popular Hollywood lore, she was not decapitated in this accident, rather she was scalped. Not that either one of these is a good way to leave this world. Three of her children were lying down in the back seat of the car that horrible night. They escaped with minor injuries.
Oh, thank God.
One of those children is Mariska Hargitay, star of Law and Order Special Victims Unit on NBC. Mariska was 3 years old when this happened. She really doesn't talk about it very much, which is understandable. But if you go to her Instagram, sometimes she will do posts to her mother. And look at the shape of the mouth, the nose, the eyes.
Those are so
so similar.
The skin tone is different, but the genetics are there for sure. And when Mariska got a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, they put it right next to her mom's.
Oh, that's so sweet.
And I think Jane would be very proud of her. And I love when these stories happen. A few years ago, an elderly woman was on my tour, and she raised her hand and said, "Excuse me, I met Jane. Can I share that story?" And I'm like,
"Oh my God, please."
Yes, please, please do. And she told me she was a school teacher in Los Angeles in the 50s and 60s and had a lot of celebrity children in her classroom. And she said anytime there was a call for parental involvement, the celebrities would never show up, except one, and that was Jane. And she said Jane was at open house asking her about her kids' homework assignments. She said Jane came to PTA meetings, that's Parent Teacher Association. I bet every male in the school district is like, "PTA, gotta be there!" Like, can you imagine? And I thought that story made her human, because normally when you hear a story about Jane Mansfield, the narrative is, oh, she flashed her breast. Oh, she was drunk. She was in a string bikini, which I don't doubt that's going to get, it's going to sell movie tickets. It's going to sell magazines. It's going to promote you, etc. But what you don't hear is that Jane was reportedly a very intelligent woman, and she was a very loving and devoted mom. And these people might be sex symbols, bombshells, icons, movie stars, all of that. But at the end of the day, they are people. And to me, that story about Jane at open house, about her kids' homework, that made Jane very real and very human to me. I am a diehard Golden Girls fan, so every time I come up to this grave, I hear Blanche Devereaux go, "My God, you're Mr. Burt Reynolds." Burt Reynolds was a mega star in the 1970s and 80s in movies like Cannonball Run, Smokey and the Bandit, Deliverance, The Longest Yard, and The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. He also got an Oscar nomination for the film Boogie Nights, which we have screened here, and he got an Emmy Award as Best Actor for the sitcom Evening Shade. Burt was handsome, charming, debonair, and a terrific movie star. He died in 2018, and even though they'd gotten a divorce, he remained very close to his ex-wife, Lonnie Anderson. I was lucky enough to get to attend the unveiling ceremony for his marker. And Lonnie spoke and said that Burt really loved the state of Florida, so she made sure that Burt had a palm tree behind him and the water in front of him so he could still kind of feel like he was back home in Florida. And there's even a QR code on the lower right side down here. If you scan your phone over it, it should pull up a website called Burt Reynolds in his own words.
Isn't that fantastic?
Yeah, I think the QR code thing might very well be in the future for memorializing people.
And for the listeners at home, it's on a big lump of marble, and then it's a bust. It really is an impressive one, isn't it?
And it was by a female sculptress that Lonnie selected and worked with to make that sculpture.
Oh, wow.
This is the grave of Virginia Rappe. Have you ever heard of her? Okay, have you heard of Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle?
Yes.
Okay, Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle was literally and figuratively the biggest star, or he was second only to Charlie Chaplin as the world's top comedian in the late teens and early 20s. Well, in 1921, he just made three films in a row back to back, and he wanted a vacation. So he and his friends got a series of suites in the St. Francis Hotel in San Francisco, which, by the way, is still there. And they threw a huge, raging party. And Virginia was invited to the party. More on that in a moment. But over the course of the party, Arbuckle and Virginia were alone in a room for about 15 minutes when Arbuckle ran out calling for help. Virginia, meanwhile, was writhing on the bed, screaming in pain and ripping off her clothes. Now, everybody is really drunk, so their judgment is not good. They started trying to sober her up with the old college-type tricks that were not working. So finally, they realized something is indeed wrong. They called the hotel management. They called a doctor. They got Virginia a separate room. And they thought, as I think a lot of us would have, okay, she's super drunk, she'll sleep it off, she'll be fine in a day or two. The party went on. And then they went back to Los Angeles. But unfortunately, Virginia's health continued to spiral out of control, and she died about 3 or 4 days after this party of peritonitis and a ruptured bladder. Her friend, Maude Delmont, accused Roscoe Arbuckle of rape and murder. He was charged with murder and thrown into jail. It would eventually be reduced down to manslaughter. He would be put through a total of 3 trials before being completely acquitted of all wrongdoing. At the 3rd trial, the jury only spent a few moments deliberating before declaring him not guilty. But it was too little too late, and the damage was already done. Arbuckle was fired by Paramount. His films were yanked from distribution, and he was basically blacklisted from the industry he helped to build. He tried owning a nightclub. He tried going on vaudeville, directing short films under an assumed name. He tried a lot of things, but time was not on his side. Over 10 years after the scandal, Jack Warner, co-founder of Warner Brothers, hired Arbuckle to do a series of short films that were sound at this point. Arbuckle appeared in these, his voice was great, he was great in them, and Jack Warner said, you know what, I'd like to get you making feature films again as a movie star. But unfortunately, before that could materialize, Arbuckle died in his sleep of a massive heart attack. He was only 46 years old. And it's tragic for Arbuckle, who I do not believe committed rape or murder here. Hi, little squirrel. You want some treats too?
And they do come over, don't they? The squirrels here at the graveyard are so friendly.
There's one guy who, he has a loved one interred here. They sit on his lap and he names them. So they're very, hey there, sweetheart, come here. Come here, it's cool. The real tragedy that often gets lost in high-profile criminal cases is the story of the victim. Oftentimes, they're treated as if their life didn't matter, especially if they weren't as wealthy, famous, or celebrated as the other party. And oftentimes, this happens to women. And Virginia's life mattered over a century ago, and it matters still today. She had a very brutal life at that. She didn't know the identity of her father. Her mother died extremely young, and she was left to be raised by her grandmother, who then died. So she was completely alone. She was completely alone in this world at a very early age. She became a professional model for graphic artists and designers. She was an actress. She was a world traveler. She designed hats and clothing. And she even gave an interview to a newspaper about ways women could create jobs and opportunities for themselves. So I think Virginia was an independent, free-spirited woman ahead of her time. But at the 3rd trial in particular, Arbuckle's defense team went on the attack. They said every horrible thing you could ever say about a woman, about her. They said she was a drunk, a tramp, had abortions, venereal disease, on and on and on. Other than the drinking, which let's face it, a lot of people did, there's no evidence to back up these other allegations. It is simply a blame the victim strategy on someone not alive to defend themselves. Virginia's one-time boyfriend, silent film comedy director Henry Lerman, defended Virginia in the press, paid for her burial here, and asked to be buried by her side 25 years later when he died in 1946. And there have been a lot of books written about this case. The problem is they're very one-sided. Either one party is the sinner, one party is the saint. Life is a lot more murky and nuanced and complicated than that. There's only one book that I recommend. It is Room 1219. It is fair to Arbuckle. It is fair to Virginia. It is extremely well-researched and well-written. As for what happened that terrible day, this theory's not in the book. However, there's a film historian colleague of mine. She is not only a biographer and a film historian, she's also a surgeon, and she was faculty at Johns Hopkins University, which is the most prestigious medical school in the country, in America. So whenever I have a medical question, she's one of the phone calls I make. And I said, Tracy, you know, what do you think happened here? And she said, well, Virginia apparently had bladder problems, and she was drinking. Not to judge in any way, but it is potentially not helpful. And when Virginia got very sick, they called a doctor. And she said they used glass or metal catheters back then. Today, they would be soft and bending plastic. So she thinks that the metal catheter or glass catheter insertion is ultimately what punctured Virginia's bladder and brought about her death. And sadly, Virginia's been treated horribly over the years. People used to leave garbage and trash on this grave. Well, there's a group on Instagram of women called the Silent Film Cemetery Project. And they adopt silent film star graves, not just here, but other cemeteries too. And they come every other week or so, and they clean them, they garden, they leave photos, they take care of them. And I love that they do that, because Virginia's life mattered, and she deserves kindness and dignity, which I think we all deserve.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.